and thank you for joining us today on the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is USU's extension entomologist, Diane Alston. And among other things, we'll be looking at some of the new news in the insect world. But we've got to start out first, though, Diane, because I want to make sure we spend enough time on this. There's no snow on the ground. Well, I've got a little bit of snow in my backyard.
Not
still.
Much.
But insect activity will quickly be ticking upward. And last week, I was at my father's house and doing some raking and so forth. And he says, well, I've got to get that dormant oil spray out. I'm like, not yet, you don't. Not up here anyway. So let's talk dormant oil.
Yeah, that's a really good topic for right now. However, I'll admit 2 weeks ago, I was down in the southwestern corner of the state. So our lowest elevations, warmest spots, and they had full apricot bloom at that time, I'm sure. And
so it's too late.
And I know they're into peach bloom now. So for those fruit trees, it is too late in those places. But most of the state, we're not there yet. So the goal of dormant oil is to apply it to fruit trees or shade trees where you've had issues with aphids or European red mite is another one that it attacks, not our regular spider mites, but European red mite, and then also scale insects. So any of those fruit shade trees where you've had issues with aphids, scale, European red mite, those are good targets for dormant oil. And oil is a just highly refined petroleum oil product. Typically, the types you want to buy are called Supreme or Superior types oil. Those are manufactured for use on trees. And you want to apply, the timing is just as the buds are swollen and starting to break open a little, you see a little hint of either green leaf tissue or pink, white flower tissue, depending on what the tree is, but before those buds have expanded to open that flower or leaf. And the reason for that timing is that is when these insects and mites are becoming active and the eggs are starting or getting close to hatching. And so that's when their respiration, their metabolism is increasing of the insect. And so when you then cover that with a layer of oil, it's very effective in suffocating that life stage of the insect or mite. Whereas if you do it too early, like your father was thinking about, you might get some mortality. But because that respiration level metabolism isn't up yet, because it's still too early, you won't get that much effect. And then the oil will be washed off, worn away by the time we do get to bud break. And you won't see the level of control that you would get if you waited until that delayed dormant timing, which is when the buds are just starting to open.
So we're using this as a mechanical means of suppression rather than using a chemical means.
Exactly. I mean, you might say an oil is a kind of chemical, which it is. But you're right. We're using a mechanical or physical means to actually suffocate the overwintering eggs or scale life stages on the tree, the limbs of the tree. And this also works very well for peach twig borer, which is the one that tunnels in the new shoots of the peach tree, and then the little chocolate brown larvae or worms get into the fruit. So those also overwinter on the limbs. And so by this physical suffocation, you're controlling that very early overwintering stage of the pest, so you get really good, knockdown of populations, which should really help you have much less problem with those pests during the growing season. And it's if you do the timing right, it's not harmful at all to the tree. It's a very safe, non-toxic kind of application.
Because people would think petroleum,
right?
But non-toxic.
But it's a very highly refined. So it's not, don't go spray your motor oil out on your fruit tree. That would be toxic for sure. It's quite, non-toxic approach as compared to insecticides that might be killing beneficial insects and so forth. But at this timing, the beneficial insects aren't out yet. And so you're just targeting those pests that are overwintering on the tree. And because it is a physical means, there's been no cases of resistance of insects to suffocation or like insecticidal soaps that disrupt the cuticle of the insect. There's been no cases of resistance.
So this will be able to continue to be used as a means.
So it's very effective. And you can get the timing right on, because you can look at each different kind of tree that you want, you decide you want to spray. If you know on your sweet cherry you had a lot of black cherry aphids last year, well, then plan to put a dormant oil spray on that tree. If you had a maple tree that had a lot of aphids last year, well, plan to put a dormant oil spray on that tree. And you can time it for the specific tree in your location based on when those buds are swollen and just starting to break, but before they've gone too far.
And this is the scaffold of the tree that we're spraying only, not the trunk.
Yeah, and the reason for that, it's good to bring that up, is that the scaffold limbs, so these are all, you know, the trunk comes up and then you get this division where all these branches come off. So those are called the scaffold limbs. So the scaffolds and then the secondary, tertiary limbs that come off of those are where these pests are overwintering. The trunk of the tree is actually a place where we get predatory mites to overwinter underneath the cracks and crevices of the bark.
And those are good.
Those are good, and so we don't want to harm those. And so we just do it from that division in the trunk into the scaffold limbs starts to occur from that point on up. And of course, a larger tree that's many feet high is going to be harder to get a good coverage as compared to a smaller tree. And that's why, particularly for fruit trees, where we tend to have these kind of annual pest problems, it's best to plant semi-dwarfing and use pruning techniques that keep the tree to a height that you can, reach with your sprayer versus having, 15, 20, 25-foot tall trees, which are very difficult to cover with any kind of spray at any time, whether it's dormant or later.
Well, I know just looking out of my house at my garden this morning, I noticed I'm going to have to lop off a few feet of an apple tree that I have, just because it's too tall. And and when I spray it in the summer for coddling moth, it's kind of hard to get all the way up to the top.
Right.
So how much of this dormant oil spray do you know to put on?
So ideally the concentration you'd like to use is a 2%. So if you're going to mix up 10 gallons, say, then you would want a 2% concentration of that total to be oil versus the water.
And the product you get will give you how many tablespoons you need.
They tell you on the label. Mm-hmm. A lot of times commercial growers, they're dealing with, 100 gallons at a time. So we say 2 gallons and 100 gallons. But obviously for a homeowner, you're not likely to have to be mixing up 100 gallons of dormant oil spray at a time.
But for the tree itself, how do you know you've gotten enough coverage?
So that's a good question. To do it on a nice day like today would be, it's too early here in Cache Valley, but this is the kind of weather. You want the temperatures to at least be, around 40s, 50s or warmer. You don't want it hot, but unlikely this time of year you wouldn't have really hot temperatures. You don't want it you don't want it below freezing. When you apply it, do it in the daytime. It'll actually darken. You can see the oil will, darken the limb color when you apply it. So you can see visually where you've applied it. And just as a point of note, for most of these pests, the key places where they are is actually on the undersides of the limbs. And you think about that, that's a strategy to avoid, impact of snow and winter weather that's going to, bear down on that tree during the winter. So if you're kind of on the underside of the limb, you're hidden from some of that impact of weather. And so that tends to be where most of the aphid eggs, scale insects tend to overwinter as well.
If I haven't seen the kind of damage that you were talking about, do I need to spray?
Then I would say no. A lot of times for people who have apple trees, for example, we often have some aphids in apples, but if you're not having a chronic problem with aphid in an apple tree or many shade trees, for example, I would say no, you don't need to put dormant oil on those trees. Only the ones where you have had consistent problems, or particularly where you saw problems last year. Doesn't guarantee you'll have the aphids again, because many of the aphids, they go to summer hosts. So they're on our fruit trees or shade trees in the spring and early summer, and then they move off to herbaceous plants for the rest of the summer. And then the adults fly back and lay their eggs on their overwintering woody hosts again in the fall. And so just because you had a lot last year doesn't always guarantee that you're going to have a lot the next year. But if you've had, a number of recent years where you've had some consistent aphid or scale problems, scale doesn't fly away, they stay there. or European red mite problems. Those are good trees to target with a dormant oil spray.
If scale don't fly, how do they get there in the first place?
Well, the males do.
Oh, okay.
Only the males.
Okay.
The females do not. And so their ability to migrate distances is very minimal, as you might expect, because they have to do it by moving. Males will fly and find the females for mating purposes. But pretty much once a tree gets some scale on it, that population builds, and it's pretty much by human intervention primarily that they'll move. The crawler stage, which is the immature stage, is the most mobile. It's teeny tiny, but it's actually it is quite mobile, crawls very fast, as the name suggests, and it will crawl between trees, often gets moved even in some wind currents from a nearby tree to another. But probably primarily it's by human activities that spread them.
I wondered, because my parents have an old Red Delicious that it's been there forever, it seems like, and it never had any scale. And then about 6 years ago, boom, it just shows up all of a sudden. So I'm thinking it must have come from maybe a neighbor.
Right.
Neighbors got some issues with theirs.
Sure. Yeah. Or just something, some fruit got brought in nearby that had some on it, and then it spread. So, I mean, they can spread short distances, but they're not a long distance.
It's amazing. They can be pretty damaging.
They can. And they tend to be a little bit cryptic because they blend into the rough bark. They look like, I mean, when they get heavy, you can see them as these little scaly, scabby looking things on the limbs. But when there's just a few of them, you don't tend to notice them. Where you often notice them first for scale, which is a place to look, is in the fall when you're picking your apples, or late summer when you're picking your peaches. If you see what looks almost like a measle kind of spot on the fruit, where there's a white center, with a dark kind of concentric ring around it, and then sometimes you'll see the scale still sticking there, and to other cases the scale has actually already fallen off. Then you'll notice, then that's a good sign that you've got scale on that tree, and you'll be aware that they're starting to build up, and you might want to put on that dormant spray the next spring.
So the dormant spray should be right now if your trees have not, if the buds are swelling and
right.
You've just seen just a little bit, a
hint of color,
either green or white.
Right, whatever, if the leaves come out first like they do on apples, or if the flowers come out first like they do on apricot or peach, you'll see that little hint of bud color opening. So when there's a little bit of color there, that's fine. The oil won't damage it. But if you already have flowers opening or leaves, getting fully expanded, then no, it's a little too late.
Then it's too late.
And you'll have to just say, well, darn, I missed it this year. I'll plan that for next year.
So what else should we be concerned about right now? Are there any control methods for other vegetables or fruits that we should be doing right now? Anything with raspberries, for instance?
Okay, well, let me first back up to also mention pear, which we talked about dormant oil, but pear also have a particular insect called the pear psylla. So if you have a pear tree in your yard and you've seen sticky honeydew dripping, and pear leaves are really sensitive to mites, to pear psylla. They almost like turn black very easily. If you've seen problems with this in the past, you would want to use that dormant oil on your pear, because this is pear psylla. And they overwinter as adults and fly it, and they overwinter on different kinds of vegetation out in our environment, and then will fly back to pear trees quite early. So they're already moving into pear trees now, or have been this past month. So make sure you use your dormant oil there. So I forgot to add that in. As far as other pests, so in your raspberries, this is a great time after we should be past our coldest temperatures now. If you're growing ever-bearing style, so the type that you want to cut back so that you get your berries more in the fall, so where the berries are being born on the primacane, so the growth that's going to grow this year that will bloom and then produce berries, that's the primacane type. Cut those back to just quite short. You can even mow them down if you have a kind of mower that can handle the canes. Because we get some of the pests, the cane borers, that overwinter in those canes, such as the raspberry horntail and the rose stem girdler. And so if it's that kind of raspberry, you want to go ahead and get those canes cut out.
Don't
leave them in the garden. Go ahead and dispose of them and put them in your green waste, or if you do some burning of prunings this time of year, you could burn them, but don't leave them laying around. And that will help reduce your populations going into this year. Now, for floricane type raspberries, those are the ones where the first year they grow the cane, and then the second year they flower and fruit. Those you want to be more, so you don't want to just go and mow them down. You won't have any berries this summer. But if you notice at the end of the cane, you see a hole where the pith has been tunneled out. That was an indication that it had a raspberry horntail in it last year. And so you should selectively prune out those. So as you're walking, you generally want to top your raspberry canes anyways to get them, you know, cut back and more manageable. A lot of people will put some trellising up, some string.
And you're thinning out the smaller ones.
You're thinning out the smaller canes. So as you're doing that kind of pruning, notice, look, as you cut the tip, if you see that a cane that has a hole in it, go ahead and prune, just go ahead and cut that whole cane out and remove that one and leave the healthy ones, because that cane has a raspberry horn tail in it.
And we'll have Brent Black, Extension Fruit Specialist, in, and we'll talk about pruning and so forth with that here. I think it'll be next week. So a lot of good things to do with there.
Yep.
And rose stem girdler seems to be a big problem as well.
I have a big problem with it in my where I live, because I live kind of on the edge of town, and there's a lot of wild rose bushes near me. And so the rose stem girdler is that's one of its native hosts. And so then they come into my raspberries. So same thing. If you what you'll notice with those is they break off where the girdler had attacked the cane, kind of about midway up typically. So if you see any of those, same thing, go ahead and prune out those canes, because the larva overwintered in that, the base of that cane.
At the base?
Well, it's right below that girdling point.
Okay.
So it's in that bottom part of the cane. So just go ahead and prune those out as you're doing this early spring pruning. And then you asked a vegetable, so nothing quite yet. I mean, it's still a little early, but I wanted to give a heads up for those who grow any of the mustard type of crops. If you grow arugula, different kinds of Asian greens, certainly, you know, broccoli and cabbage and things a little later.
Radishes,
but mostly those kind of early mustard type greens and so forth. The flea beetles love those. And we have a lot of flea beetles in Cache County, and I'm sure all up and down, you know, at least in northern Utah. I don't know if there's much of an issue in the south. And so we have a lot of mustard weeds, or, you know, native plants and weeds that are of the mustard family. And so they overwinter as adults there and then fly into our early gardens, and where our little radishes and arugula are just coming up and can really hammer them when they're seedlings. There's some species that attack beans and potatoes, tomatoes. If you've ever had those little windy trails on your potatoes when you harvested them, on your carrots, those are from larvae of flea beetles. So early on, what you can do is use floating row cover or fabric. It's a lightweight fabric where the sunlight goes through and water will penetrate. But you can cover up those early greens to keep the flea beetles off, and that just helps get them a start, and they won't be as decimated by the flea beetles.
So maybe as soon as you plant, put that floating row cover over the top.
Right. And just keep the flea beetles off. Because once they come, then they'll start laying eggs in the soil next to the plant. And then you have larvae and another generation coming on. But if you get them covered early and exclude the flea beetles right up front, then that really helps get you a jump start.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. Diane Alston, USU's Extension Entomologist, is my guest. If you have a question or comment, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. I wanted to look at some of these issues, some of the new discoveries, like we usually do. And one of those that seemed kind of fascinating to me at the time was this migratory route that they thought the monarch butterfly had the longest migration in the insect world, but apparently that's not the case.
Yeah, there's some new research out of insect biologists at Rutgers University in New Jersey have been studying this dragonfly that does occur here in North America, but they knew that it's also very widespread across the world. There's populations in Korea, Japan, India, Africa. And the assumption had always been that they are, it's the same species, or maybe, you know, or we think it's the same species. We're not always sure. But we just assume that they're distinctly, you know, the reproductive populations are distinct. So those in Africa are of the African type, and here in North America, it's different. But they started looking at the genetics of this particular dragonfly. It's a pretty small one, too. It's only about an inch and a half long. So as dragonflies go, it's not a large dragonfly. It's called Pantala flavensis. It didn't give a common name, so I don't think it has one. But they'd started looking at the genetics of these dragonflies from many different places around the world and found that their genetics, their genome is exactly the same, pretty much, which suggests that they're not distinctly breeding populations, but they're interbreeding populations. So how can that be? How can dragonflies that are in India be the same as they are here in North America? And so what they decide is that they actually have a pretty great migration. And the author of this research points out that these dragonflies will fly at night. Most dragonflies only fly during the day, but these fly at night. And so they feel that they get up on these big air currents that are moving, especially when there's storm systems or that kind of thing, and they move them across oceans and across continents. They also feel that probably some of the individuals move on a slower way by puddle jumping, where they are flying at lower altitudes and when they see water, because dragonflies are aquatic in their immature stages, and so they have to lay their eggs in the water. So when they see water sources, they'll fly down and lay their eggs, but they have a very short generation time, so then pretty soon these offspring are up and moving and doing the same thing. So there's a lot of this intermixing of the genetics. And so it was just really interesting to now know that we have another insect that
intercontinental dragonfly. Any idea why they would travel from one continent to another? Why would they develop that long migration?
I think especially in places like India and Africa, where their seasons are much more associated with wet and dry seasons. Again, because this is, you know, all dragonflies are aquatic, and at least a good chunk of their life stage, they're very adapted to need water, surface water, to be able to complete their life cycle. And so if you're in India and now it's the dry season, what are you going to do? You either have to develop some strategies to survive the dry season, kind of hang out, lay low, or you move. And so this is a species that obviously is adapted to moving and then great distances, because they sometimes have to move a long ways to then find that next available water source. So, but just some really, I think they said it migrates over 4,000 miles,
That
right?
4,400 miles, which is longer than Lindbergh's
flight. From where did he fly from?
From New York to Paris.
Yeah, yep. So that's pretty impressive.
And monarch butterflies were only 2,500 miles.
So that makes them seem a small migrator in comparison, doesn't it?
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back. Hope your questions or comments will be in. It's The Zesty Garden. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist. Toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495, or send us an email question at zestygarden@gmail.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and Diane Alston, USU's extension entomologist, is in studio with me today. Our toll-free number for your questions or comments is 1-800-826-1495, or send us an email question, zestygarden@gmail.com. So one of the next things that topics to look at, scientists have sequenced the genome of the tick that transmits Lyme disease. I was astonished with how many were involved with this, 93 authors and 46 institutions, all for this little insect.
Right.
Why? Why so much effort?
Why so much? Well, it's more work, documenting or decoding the genome of an organism than we think, even if it's a relatively small organism like a tick. The other part of why I think it took so many people is that there really had been very little work done on the genetics of ticks previously. So this is kind of like a big breakthrough project for ticks. And so because of that, it's it's kind of, you know, not every, you assume, well, if people are decoding genes, you know, you've done the fruit fly, you can do anything else. Well, every organism is different. And there wasn't a lot of previous work with ticks. And so they had to kind of start from scratch. And so I think that was a big reason why it took so many people. And it was a complicated genome. So it took a bit. They've really found a lot of genes and a lot of proteins and different interesting things that their genes are coding for.
And the tick has been around for a very long time.
Very long time. So I want to point out that they mentioned that this is the tick that transmits Lyme disease. That title isn't completely accurate because I'm looking at it from a Western perspective. So this is the black-legged tick. It's Ixodes scapularis, which is the key tick for like the northeastern U.S., which is where the majority of Lyme disease cases have been. This is the tick. However, here in the West, we have a relative, Ixodes pacificus, which is the Pacific or Western black-legged tick. And so it's closely related, but it is not the exact same species as this one. So I just wanted to point that out.
Okay.
There are other closely related ticks that can also vector Lyme disease. But why this work was so fascinating, I think, is, again, just because it is the first work done with decoding the genome of a tick. But what they found was that ticks have an amazing number of different kind of chemicals in their saliva. And so now they've learned about which genes are coding for the proteins that make all these thousands of compounds that are found in tick saliva. And so they found, we knew about some of these already, but just didn't know the extent of what was there. Antimicrobials, pain inhibitors, cement type compounds, anticoagulants, immune suppressors. And so that all those things tell you about why when you get a tick on you, you don't feel it, because they have all these chemicals that are you know, basically medicating you. They're injecting it right into your bloodstream so that you don't, there's a painkiller, so you don't feel that there's that little bite there where the tick's got its mouth parts inserted in you. And it anticoagulants that make your blood flow more easily, and you, so you don't notice that. And so it's not until the tick gets fairly large in size that you start to see it, that you say, oh, I've got a tick on me, and you remove it at that point. But by then, it doesn't take long for them to transmit the Lyme disease or other pathogens that they can vector.
And in comparison, it was saying mosquito saliva has just hundreds of these compounds, where the tick has thousands.
Right. And so I think that was very fascinating to them. And so it comments about how complex their genome is, because they have these genes that code for this myriad of different kinds of compounds. The other things that were interesting is they learned more about the genes that are, if you know about ticks, you know how much they can increase in body size during the time that they're getting a blood meal on a host. And so they start off really teeny tiny. That's why we often don't see them at first. And they get in cryptic places on the body. But then by the time they're finished, they're huge. You know, hundred plus size body increase in size. And so how does a organism, how can you adapt to that? Could we increase 100 times in our body size? Would our skin be able to handle that?
No. I've increased a little more than I want, but
but we obviously have limitations to how much
Yes.
we can increase. Excuse me. So ticks, they learned about how they can synthesize new armor-like cuticle as they feed to allow them to expand over 100 times in body size. So I think that's a pretty interesting. As we can study this and figure out how this works in future research, I think it will really allow us to make some great strides in how to better manage ticks.
Because they might be able to hone in on one of these compounds.
Right. And if you could treat them with a growth regulator type compound that's just specific to ticks and not going to hurt people or animals, you could keep them from growing in size, and they'd basically burst their body and, you know, they wouldn't live very long kind of thing. The other thing was about some of the detoxification enzymes, and especially involved in blood digestion. We don't really think about how it's hard to digest blood. There's only select groups of organisms that have evolved to be able to digest blood because of the iron, the heme compounds. And so ticks are obviously a group that are very well adapted to that. And so, again, getting a better understanding about how they're able to deal with some of these toxins in their environment, like things in the blood that most organisms can't deal with.
And speaking of insects that can process blood,
Yes, we have another one about that.
The photos that come, these topics are coming from entomology today, and you can sign up and get a post that comes once or maybe every other day. And this particular one has to do with an insect that I've seen before. I haven't been punctured by it, but the assassin bug. And so what do we talk about? Bacteria can be used for RNA interference in insects.
Right. So this was a study that was done. It's kind of early stages. It was from Swansea University. So early stage, you know, very basic early stage research, kind of proof of concept kind of thing, where they use two different insects. One is what we call the kissing bug, which is a kind of assassin bug. We don't have them here in U.S. North America. We do have a relative called the black masked hunter, which some of us may have been bitten by, but it does not vector the trypanosome that causes the Chagas disease. But the other insect they looked at was Western flower thrips, so just a very, you know, relatively benign insect, at least from human health standards. But what they did was they used bacteria that are symbiotic in the gut, in the system of the insect. So they're natural bacteria, very specific for each different kind of insect. And they, in the lab, injected some RNA, some different genes to code for something. And then they use these symbiotic bacteria to transfer it into the insect body and system. And so they had good success with both the kissing bug and the Western flower thrip. So what they're hoping is that with this kind of technology, they could now move it into organisms that we really want to control. Well, kissing bug is one, but we're thinking about like the Aedes mosquitoes, like Aedes aegypti, which is the vector for Zika virus, chikungunya, dengue fever, you know, some very nasty diseases around the world. And if you could change the genome of the mosquito so that it either dies or doesn't reproduce or in some way doesn't successfully vector the pathogen, then that would be a tremendous success in terms of reducing the threat of some of these diseases around the world.
On the flip side of that, not that I especially like these insects, but what niche are they filling in the environment that we possibly could be interrupting?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, every organism is here for some kind of purpose. Some of those purposes may be things that we as humans don't particularly like, but they do fill a purpose. So think about other kinds of mosquitoes, not necessarily talking about Aedes aegypti or malaria-carrying mosquitoes, but think about if you visited Alaska in the summer, what might you see? A lot of mosquitoes biting you, yes, but what else? What is the purpose of those mosquitoes? Who's eating them? What role are they filling in that environment? Do you have an idea?
Bats. I'm just thinking of my own backyard.
Right. Birds. So a lot of the whole food web, the kind of the ecosystem in a place like northern Canada, Alaska, why they have such tremendous wildlife diversity. I don't want to say it's all attributed to the mosquito, but the mosquito is obviously a very important food source for smaller organisms in that system, which then larger organisms eat the smaller organisms and so on. So, you know, you likely wouldn't have the diversity of wildlife, for example, in the northern reaches of our country, of our world, if we didn't have mosquitoes. So they do play a role. I don't want to say that we always fully appreciate what they do.
Well, Diane, we've reached the end of our time.
It always goes so fast, Brian.
Does. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Diane Alston is USU's extension entomologist and joins us the second Thursday of every month, so we'll have her back in April. So in our gardening calendar, there are quite a few items that are popping up, and so get out your pen or pencil and jot these down. The plant propagation workshop for Cache County Extension is tonight from 6 to 9 p.m., And this Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon at the USU Teaching Greenhouse at 1390 North, 800 East in North Logan, you'll receive native and water-wise plants for your own yard. The cost is $30 and includes an online workbook, seeds, and planting materials. Participants will take home 60 planted seeds. Registration is required by calling 752-6263. Juab County Extension in Nephi offers a class tonight from 7 to 8 p.m. on water-wise plants and easy landscaping. Participants will learn how to conserve water by using plants with low water requirements. Low-maintenance landscaping will also be taught. The class is at the Juab County Center Cultural Hall, 160 North Main in Nephi. Registration is free and is at 435-623-3450. Help the Moab Charter School do a spring tidy-up of their bee-inspired garden. Volunteers will spread mulch, prune plants, and more. Bring your garden gloves, pruning tools, and shade hat. A snack will be provided. The event is tomorrow, March 11th, from 2 to 5 p.m. The Pollinator Garden is at 358 East, 300 South in Moab. No registration is required. Just show up. This Saturday from 9 a.m. to noon is a fruit tree pruning demonstration at the USU Botanical Center in Kaysville. USU Extension experts will show you the art and science of proper pruning practices so you'll be ready to prune your fruit trees, raspberries, blackberries, and grapes with confidence. Dress for the outdoor conditions. Register for free for a chance to win a free set of pruners at usubotanicalcenter.org. Another fruit pruning demonstration is also this Saturday, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Thanksgiving Point in Utah County. Information is at thanksgivingpoint.org. Then on Saturday, March 19th, the City of St. George is hosting the Spring into Veggie Gardening class at 10 a.m. at the Tahnaquit Nature Center. You'll receive tips on planting and growing spring vegetables in southern Utah. The class is free, but reservations are required by calling the Washington County Water Conservation District at 435-673-3671. And then the USU Washington County Extension Office is offering a course to become a certified master preserver by learning how to properly preserve foods. All canning, freezing, and drying techniques are taught for meat, vegetables, fruits, jams, jellies, pickles, jerky, and more. The complete guide to home canning and the Ball Blue Book are included, along with other handouts and recipes. Classes are every Tuesday evening, March 15th. Through April 12th, 6 to 9 p.m. at the USU Washington County Extension Office, 475 Donnelly Drive in St. George. Registration is $100 at extension.usu.edu/Washington. If you have an item for the Zesty Garden calendar, wherever you listen to us, let us know about it by sending it to zestygarden@gmail.com. Coming up next is Petals and Prose with Nancy Williams.
Good morning, I'm Nancy Williams, finishing my little several readings from one of my favorite cookbooks, With a Measure of Grace, by Blake Spaulding and Jennifer Castle, and which is a story and recipes of a small town restaurant called Hill's Backbone Grill in Boulder, Utah. This is what they write about winter, because they do close that restaurant from I think probably New Year's Day to March, at least, maybe even before New Year's Day, depending on weather. And this is what they write on winter. Take a rest. A field that is rested gives a bountiful crop, is a wonderful quote from Ovid. Boulder winters are so quiet, you could take a nap in the middle of the road, if it weren't covered with a foot of snow, that is. No tourists come through town this time of year because many of the roads are impassable, making it even trickier than usual to reach Boulder. In the winter, Boulder epitomizes sleepy little town. The locals, who customarily squeeze so much work into each day that there's no time left for leisure, are at last forced to slow down. We take it one step further. We don't merely slow down, we come to a full stop. From mid-November to early March, the doors are closed. But before the grand blind dropping, sign posting, and door locking, and going off for a long winter's nap ceremony can kick off, Hellas must be rocked gently to sleep. As with any young child, that takes some doing. the garden comes first. It's a job that begins in late fall when our last crops are past their prime and the gardeners start the somewhat elaborate process of seed saving. Allowing some crops to go to seed enables us all to cull the seeds and use them again the following year. It is a more cost-effective way of gardening, but requires some time and effort. When a plant has gone to seed, we carefully collect the seed heads or pods and lay them on paper towels for 2 weeks until no moisture remains, after which we label and store them in tightly closed glass jars. We save every possible seed for planting in the coming spring. The only kind we haven't had much luck with is squash, which cross-pollinates easily and can result in weird and unusually inedible variations. So unless you're interested in mutant pumpkins, it's a bit of a disappointment. Next on the list is to remove everything from the garden. The gardeners till the soil and plant cover crops like legumes, buckwheat, and vetches to add organic matter and fix nitrogen into the soil. They cut any remaining flowers so we can use them as garnish and harvest the last of the herbs, which we dry. Drying herbs concentrates their flavor. When substituting dried herbs in recipes that call for fresh, reduce your dose. Our general rule is 1 teaspoon of crumbled dried herbs for every tablespoon of fresh chopped herbs. Drying herbs is not labor-intensive, but the sifting, sorting, cleaning, and separating will occupy a good couple of afternoons that might otherwise be spent doing yoga or watching Sex and the City reruns on video. 1 garbage bag of fresh herbs yields approximately 1 large Ziploc of dried. But if you have the time and the floor or counter space, it's more than worth it. The first time I dried herbs, Jen said, I had pictured cute tiny bundles hanging in front of my windows, perfuming my house. Instead, I had a big mess in my living room. The process of drying herbs is similar to that of saving seeds. Spread them out on paper towels or sheets if you're drying in bulk, turning them every few days. Herbs tend to dry at different rates. Thyme, for instance, will dry in just a few days, whereas parsley can take a full week. It depends on the temperature and humidity in your home. A temperature of about 85 degrees is best, with humidity below 60%. The last step in putting the garden to sleep is to overwinter it, which involves burying the garden and any remaining living plants, like carrots or beets, in straw mulch. It will lie dormant during the winter until we uncover it in March, dig up the carrots, and start fresh. At the end of the season, Blake sits down with the gardener to map out the garden for the following season and take stock of what seeds we have available and what we need to order. We purchase seeds from the High Altitude Seed Trust, Native Seeds Search, Seeds for Change, Peaceful Valley, and Planet Natural. All these companies offer organic seeds. Native Seeds Search carries a variety of regional southwestern plants and heirloom varieties. With the business of the garden checked off the list, we only have to clean the restaurant, an operation that doubles as a party. Loud, loud music, so loud everyone has to yell to ask where the extra citrusole is kept, or what should be done with the purple feather boa that someone just found in the closet. We finally address the teetering piles of notes, recipes, Polaroids, many taken by BJ, of Tashi sitting at the table with various and sundry people, and old grease-spattered menus. We dole out any food that won't keep for 5 months, and we take inventory. Then, drumroll, we close the blinds, hang up the sign, lock the doors, and just walk away, Renee. Hibernation, relaxation. Time holds still in Boulder as layers of sparkling snow cover the ground and mountains. The thick square buttes come to look like giant blocks of vanilla ice cream. The stillness and silence are astonishing. Like everyone else in town, we've stockpiled food and firewood. Now we sleep in, take 2 hours to drink our morning coffee, stay in our pajamas until midday. We have time to play canasta with Breck and BJ, visit our families, travel to New Mexico, Arizona, and California, and finally, call our friends in other towns to reassure them that we haven't been run over by a tractor. Like fishermen who spend their winters repairing nets, we spend our winters readying ourselves for the coming season, answering long overdue correspondence, organizing, making repairs to the kitchen equipment, laying in a stock of supplies. Through the month, we continue to make improvements to the grill. But otherwise, we try our best to shed our restaurant skins. The only cooking we do is for ourselves and friends who drop by, roasted chicken and veggies, or deep, hearty pots of pozole. We accept every dinner invitation that comes our way, giving others the chance to cook for us, and we realize with fantastic clarity how disconnected our lives become from our families and our friends during the cruel 9-month schedule of the season, when the boundaries between work and life barely exist. Winter reminds us that we do have a life. In an agrarian, rural community such as this one, everything turns inward to the winter. There are few out-of-town visitors. Instead, the community reconnects. People host dinner parties and cook and bake for one another. Not everyone stays home. Many locals take advantage of the slow winter to travel. The Cochrans, for example, Bob, Sue, and their boys Rye, Crew, and Dawes, 15, 13, and 11. The Cochrans are cattle ranchers. They own the 160-acre Boulder Mountain Ranch and run an outfitting business, leading tourists on horseback through Utah's backcountry. They've taken us horseback riding, and their son Rye is one of our dishers. In the winter, the Cochrans hang a sign across the gate at Boulder Mountain Ranch that says, "Gone surfing." Then the hard-working cowboy family trades in boots for flip-flops, throws surfboards in the back of their pickup, and heads to the beaches of Mexico. Us, we rest. We sit and read, do crafts, savor the long, unoccupied afternoons. Jen bakes and cooks to warm her house. We watch movies. Time passes slowly. It's a funny, old-fashioned life we lead in the winter, but it's authentic. It's our reward for working hard the rest of the year. And if we've learned anything from our time in Boulder, we've learned bedrock survival. If you want to survive, you work as hard and as well as you possibly can, because it makes all the rest that much more beautiful. Naturally, because it's Hill's Backbone Grill, one of the best house salads in the whole state, or maybe the whole world, is made there. So I'd like to give you the recipe today for the Backbone House Salad. Salt Lake Magazine recognized this salad as one of the best in the state, and it's easily our most requested recipe. We top our salad with seasonal fruit from local orchards. In early spring, we order strawberries from our suppliers until our own are ready to harvest. As always, the freshest, locally grown organic ingredients make a world of difference. Build the salad on individual plates in the order the ingredients are listed, and drizzle with our house honey chili dressing. I'll give you both of those recipes. The salad is built this way, in this order: romaine hearts torn into small pieces, garden spring mix, jicama sliced into matchstick-sized pieces, toasted pepitas, which are just hulled pumpkin seeds, super sweet dehydrated corn, sliced fresh fruit, strawberries, cherries, plums, raspberries, peaches, pears, or apricots, whatever is in season and in your fridge. That's the entire salad. You just stack it up like that, and then you drizzle it with honey chili dressing, which you make from 1/2 cup of red wine vinegar, 1/4 cup of honey, 3/4 teaspoon of ground star anise, 1/4 teaspoon of Dijon mustard, 1 teaspoon of Chamayo red chili powder, 1/4 teaspoon of salt, and 1 cup of canola oil. You combine all the ingredients except the oil in a blender. With the machine running, slowly dribble in the oil. Whirl a minute to combine. The dressing will keep for 10 days in the fridge. And that is it. So with that, I thought that green salad would just be perfect to spark up our evening wait for spring for dinner. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you for listening today. I'm Nancy Williams for Zesty Garden, and you can get this recipe, by the way, on the Zesty Garden website, which is upr.org, by clicking the tab for Zesty Garden and looking for today's date. Thanks. See you next time.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.